spate of flash mob robberies at high-end stores in and around the San Francisco Bay Area, the city of Los Angeles, Chicago, Illinois, and various other cities throughout the United States have made headlines in recent weeks. Tens of thousands of dollars worth of jewelry, sunglasses, clothes, and other merchandise have been stolen in these brazen robberies. Law enforcement officials believe the thefts are the work of organized crime networks, recruiting young people to steal valuable merchandise and then sell it online. We're not talking about someone who needs money or needs food. These are people who go out and do this for high profit and for the thrill, said Ben Duggan, president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail. The people recruited to perform the thefts are paid $500 to $1,000 to take as much merchandise as they can or steal specific items and bring it to certain people who then send it to other parts of the country to be resold, the Associated Press has reported. The so-called criminal flash mobs are a growing trend designed to look chaotic, but law enforcement officials say they are quite the opposite and can also hide in and around other events. During the protests across the United States and in San Francisco area in the summer of 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, Ben Duggan, the president of the Coalition of Law Enforcement and Retail, said, during the protests across the United States and in San Francisco, California in the summer of 2020, following the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, similar thievery took place in multiple U.S. cities. Ben Duggan added, it was meant to look like looting, but it really wasn't. It's a criminal entity employing other people to steal for them so they can profit by selling it online.
Start. Movement. Speak. Live in hope. Tour the pit. On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the merciful, this is Youth Station, and I'm glad to be here. Well, we have my friend.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa salam alaikum.
I'm Zainab, Sister Asma's co-host, and I'm totally happy to be with you guys today.
Okay, then today we're going to talk about some very important things, some very important issues. It's going to be some personal points we add to your information. So now let's talk about when we are alone. What do we do when we are alone? Okay, so that's a very good job. I do that too. Is it really satisfying?
To an extent.
Yes, what does it do to you?
Sometimes it's a good gap filler for when you're waiting for the cab, for your, I don't know, waiting for the producer to set up the microphone. And if you've already prepared the content you want to talk about, you just want to take the edge off.
Yes.
And, you know, fill that little few moments, kill time, as they say. And you scroll through, like, what did my friends post?
Yes.
What did that so-and-so scholars say this really cute quote. Oh, look at that meme of that cat.
Yes, exactly.
And you get a giggle out of it, and all this fun is all this fun.
It takes us away from reality.
For a second or so.
For some seconds.
But then sometimes I feel like...
But time really flies when we're doing
yes.
that.
Sometimes it's a good thing because I don't like the time I'm in right
yes.
now in
we
my solitude.
We lose the track of time, and that's a good thing most of the times recently.
Yeah. But the problem is,
yes,
things like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter have been designed to grant you a sort of immediate gratification, instant gratification,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And that little spike of adrenaline or serotonin that you have,
yes,
creates an addiction.
Of course.
And then these little gap fillers that you call it, just to kill those 5 minutes, 3 minutes, 15 minutes that you have between classes, between whatever, turns into, like you said, an hour, two, three, four.
Happens to take half of your day.
Before you know it, half of your day is gone.
Yes.
With your index finger scrolling through the page
of
your
phone.
And
we do not feel it.
We don't even feel it. Right. And then after a while, first time, second time, we might feel guilty about it. But after a while, we even become desensitized. We feel like it's just a part of our normal life.
Yes.
And this is how we spend our moments of solitude, which sucks.
Yes.
Those moments of solitude are the most valuable, precious, cherishable moments.
But what else would we do?
Read a book, maybe?
Yes, we read. Using my cell phone, I read books.
Yes. Oh, really? You're one of those?
Yes.
Get out.
No, but I love books more.
Yeah.
Some short pieces I read.
I knew it.
Yes.
Yeah, there is no... I do not
the
trust...
The sense of the books...
I don't trust a person who says I enjoy PDF books more than hardcovers.
No.
I don't trust
them.
Yes.
I'm not one of them.
Those are the kind of people that just want to watch the world burn.
Yes.
You know? And I just don't want that. I don't need that kind of vibe in my life. Thank you.
Yes.
Please. Sayyid al-Qaid, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yes.
He was saying to the youth, and he addresses the youth very often. He has so much faith in us, and that's so scary sometimes. He was like, fill those moments with reciting the Quran.
Exactly.
Why
yes.
not?
Yes, of course.
You've
Why
got
not?
15 minutes to kill. You can read 3-4 pages within
Yes,
those
and that gives
minutes.
You a sense of happiness as well.
And fulfillment.
And
add
you're
to
not,
your knowledge.
Yes, and you're not remorseful for what you have done.
During those times of solitude when I'm alone with myself, sometimes I'm so burned out from work that I feel I don't want to read a book. I don't want to pick up my hobbies. I don't want to learn a new language. I don't want to freaking meditate. I want to mindlessly scroll through Instagram.
Yes.
Okay?
I told you, that takes us away from reality.
Yes.
That's a good point of it.
Sometimes, yes. Once a week, twice a week, you're allowed to do that.
But when it becomes an addiction, that
scary.
Becomes dangerous.
Any addiction is scary.
Yes, any kind of addiction is too bad.
You can't force yourself into the habit of doing something productive if your other habits during other hours of the day weren't very healthy.
Exactly. That's true.
Right?
Yes.
It requires a synchronized planned system.
Yes.
For you to
Definitely.
Wake up at a, sleep at a certain hour, so you can wake up at a certain hour, have a healthy diet, have a healthy working schedule.
Yes, yes.
Don't run yourself down and burn yourself out and then expect yourself to, you know, drink a cup of lemon balm with a really good classic book and some relaxing music in the
smell
background.
Of rain.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't know, lavender essential oil burning
candles.
No, it doesn't work that way.
No, of course not.
No. You have to plan to have
certain things at certain times.
Yes, productive, healthy alone time.
Exactly. Productivity is very important.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's talk about when you are in a hardship.
Mm.
What do you do in those moments?
I drink chai. I'm not even exaggerating.
Seriously? And does that work?
That works for me.
It's too good.
Dude, chai, man. I don't know who invented it, but I'm pretty sure they're in heaven now.
But I overthink.
Really?
Yes.
While you're drinking chai. And then your chai gets cold. You're one of those.
Yes.
But you still drink chai, right?
I
do you find solace in overthinking? Do you find comfort in it?
Solace. Well, never.
Why do you do it then?
Because it's a habit.
Ah. Of course it is.
It happens. And so naturally. I don't know, when did it become a part of me?
Does it bother you so much?
Yes, a lot.
Have you tried anything to fight it off?
Yes, I go to gym and I watch movies in order just to forget about the thing I'm thinking about.
Let's define hardship, though. What do you mean by times of hardship? Is it financial hardship, health hardship-ish sort of thing?
No, mental hardships.
Oh, darn, that's the worst kind.
Yes, that's
still chai. Solution is still chai.
I don't think so.
For you?
Yes.
Chai is my solution to everything. I can't sleep, chai. I'm hungry, chai. I'm stressed out, chai. I've just woken up. I need to little pick-me-up, chai.
That's too good.
And it actually fixes things.
I wish I had such a...
You should try it. I really
such a painkiller.
In life, we need to find something that anchors us.
Of course, but the thing
God
that anchors
us
is our creed, I guess.
Yes,
the
absolutely.
Thing
that no, little
us.
Things, little anchors.
Little anchors, yes, the way you put it. Maybe reading books, maybe watching movies, maybe chai, exactly the way you said. But when it becomes so deep, the only thing that anchors us is our creed, the things that we believe in.
Definitely.
The things that our prophet and his companions has always recommended us to do. Pray, read Quran, or do anything like that.
Or just chill with God.
Yes.
Have a heart-to-heart with him.
Exactly. Speak to him like
exactly.
to a friend.
Exactly. You don't necessarily have to pray or recite
yes.
a certain supplication.
Have a special
or
place or
sit in there.
Do certain
sit
things
there with
just
him
to speak
silence.
To him.
Yeah. You know, what you just said reminded me of that hadith from Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, in kunta bakiyan li shay fabki lil Hussein.
Yes, exactly.
I feel like, yeah, that's a solution to all my problems.
Yes, it's a very good solution.
In kunta bakiyan li shay fabki lil Hussein. فبچه علال حسین مظلوم کربلا فبچه علال حسین.
Because often we feel when our problems and hardships reach a certain degree, we feel like, okay, this is the point where I need to cry this
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And
the best thing to cry for
is Imam al-Hussein
exactly.
alayhi salam. Because, first of all, it makes you closer to your imam. Second of all, it...
You're not crying for something that is worthless.
Yes, and futile.
Your cry becomes worthy.
Exactly.
Every drop is something that's going to help you in future. Mm. And of course, it will solve your problem.
Yeah, exactly. It's a win-win situation.
Exactly.
Also, it puts the hardship that you're facing at that moment into perspective.
Yes.
I'm not trying to gaslight anyone into thinking that, dude, your problem is nothing compared to the problem
no,
of Imam al-Hussein.
I get what you're saying.
Your problem is valid, but I'm saying that once we engulf ourselves
yes.
with the ocean, which is Aba Abdullah al-Hussein
yes.
alayhi salam,
when we're linked
we feel,
to him.
Yes.
Yes.
We relate to him, and we feel that even our problem now is within his embrace.
Insignificant.
Yes.
They are important, but they're insignificant
and
compared to the hardships.
And you feel like you learn how to cope with your problem from the way Imam al-Hussein coped with it.
Exactly.
How to practice that sabrun jameel, that
yes.
beautiful patience. One of my friends was saying something really interesting about this. He said that it got me thinking, how can you be beautifully patient? There's nothing beautiful about being patient.
Yes.
You're in this really uncomfortable, hard...
That's so painful.
Traumatic experience.
Yes.
You just want it to pass. You just want to get away from it. And you have to be patient. Which part of that can you possibly make beautiful?
Yes,
and that's
exactly.
the secret, right?
Yes.
Once you have a Husseini mentality toward it.
Exactly.
Once you feel that I am doing this for the sake of God because I know this place I am in now is where God wants me to be.
And you feel him. You feel that he's witnessing you.
Yes.
He's there for you. And he would never let you down. So
for
that's
sure.
a pacifier.
And then you get to the point where you're ma ra'aytu illa jamila.
Exactly.
I see nothing but beauty.
Yes.
Because I had that beautiful patience.
Yes, that's true. So, what about when you're with your friend?
When it does happen? Is it a good thing to be around your friend?
Oh, yeah, I love my friends.
Exactly.
They're awesome people. That's why they're my friends. If I'm going through some sort of conflict with my friends, which I hate
to death. Oh, that's a difficult part of the story.
Chai is still the solution.
Again, chai.
I tell them to come have chai with me.
That's very good. I have those moments too.
And it's then, you know, conflict gone.
Yes.
Just have chai. Or like when I'm...
You forget about everything.
Everything.
How come?
Sometimes I feel like I'm literally in the middle of actively having an argument with my friend. We've reached the point of raising our voices.
Yes, yes.
And then one of us turns to the other and goes, do you want some chai?
Yes.
De-escalate it.
Yes. Everything is gone.
That very moment, it's like water on fire.
Yes.
You know? You want some chai?
Yes.
And the problem goes.
Like what happens with your brothers and sisters. Like the family. Because friends, after a special time, they become your family.
For sure.
So they know when to say, do you want some chai?
God bless them, God, and God bless chai. And God bless all of our listeners. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of Youth Station. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong because of you. In weakness I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker, abiding in silence with patience and guidance. When I need you, the light, when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi hosted his Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian in the city of Wuxi in Jiangsu province on Friday.
The Chinese and Iranian foreign ministers announced the launch of a 25-year cooperation agreement aimed at strengthening economic and political ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the strategic cooperation agreement between Tehran and Beijing is built on a win-win approach in line with the interests of both countries. The Iranian diplomat outlined the latest state of bilateral cooperation in various fields and said Tehran is resolved to implement all infrastructure agreements with Beijing. Iran and China signed the landmark Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership Agreement in March last year in defiance of the U.S. unilateral sanctions to strengthen the long-standing economic and political alliance. It paves the way for Iran's participation in the Belt and Road Initiative, a massive infrastructure project stretching from East Asia to Europe. Meanwhile, Beijing once again voiced its firm opposition to unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States against Iran. The Chinese foreign minister said the U.S. bears primary responsibility for the ongoing difficulties with Iran, having unilaterally withdrawn from a 2015 nuclear deal. The United States reimposed the sanctions that the agreement had removed and slapped new bans under different labels. Wang said China firmly opposes unilateral sanctions against Iran, political manipulation through topics including human rights and interference in the internal affairs of Iran and other regional countries. He also noted that Beijing completely supports Iran's wise stand toward the bullying policies of the United States, and also its position on the ongoing talks with the five remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear agreement, urging Washington to make up for the past mistake in withdrawing from the deal.
That this 25-year agreement with China represents new possibilities for Iran to really, if not break out of the sanctions, at least they have a lifeline for the things that they will need thanks to this long-term agreement with China. And for China, of course, it's a major undertaking because it is long-term. They do expect it to last over two decades. So this is something that is a permanent feature of the political architecture. And I think it represents a tremendous opening for Iran to retake its own rightful place in the array of nations of the world, in the Middle East and globally.
Since Washington's 2018 withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal, followed by subsequent sanctions aimed at crushing the Iranian economy, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has underlined the necessity of pressing ahead with efforts to neutralize the sanctions. Under that strategy, Iran has tried to adopt an East-oriented economic policy, expanding its ties with neighboring and other Asian countries and striving to become self-sufficient in key domains. China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from the country. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. Also, a review of trade between Iran and Russia shows Tehran's exports to Moscow increased by 58%, including 62% in agricultural and food products in the first 9 months of the current Persian year, which ends on March 20th. Tehran says a long-term cooperation roadmap between Iran and Russia is at its final stage of development as the Islamic Republic takes the initiative to expand its ties with neighboring, regional, and friendly countries to neutralize sanctions.
China and Russia are fighting back. They're going to be playing a major role. They're going to maintain their relations with the countries that they have a good relationship with and Iran is one of these. And they're not going to be bullied by the independent or unilateral sanctions or even any other sanctions that would be placed on a country like Iran.
Tehran has also pursued the removal of sanctions through diplomatic channels, including the negotiations in Austria's capital, Vienna.
The eighth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA goes on in Vienna to revive the deal.
Tehran says all anti-Iran sanctions should be removed in a verifiable manner. Tehran also says the U.S. should give guarantees that it won't leave the deal again.
Tensions between Russia and the West are spiraling out of control. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to invade its western neighbor, Ukraine, citing increased Russian military activities along the border. Russia rejects the allegation and says its military buildup is to ensure security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Back in December, Russia proposed two draft treaties to Washington and NATO that demanded assurances that western troops won't be deployed near Russian borders. Last week, U.S. and Russian officials held talks over the tensions. Soviet representatives from NATO and Moscow to de-escalate the situation. The talks ended without any significant breakthrough. Russia now says it has run out of patience with the West as tensions escalate over Ukraine. Moscow expects the U.S. and NATO to provide by next week a detailed written response to its security demands.
We're waiting for the written reaction. We have reasons to believe that our partners have understood the necessity to react quickly, precisely, and on paper. And they have understood that we're not going to wait forever. But of course, there are plans to drag it on and on.
Sergei Lavrov says Moscow needs legally binding guarantees, and meeting these demands would be essential for finding a diplomatic solution. According to Lavrov, his country has various options if the West rejects its security proposals.
I think the most likely thing is that they would announce that they're putting ships off the American coast with hypersonic weapons on them that could reach American cities within 5 or 7 minutes, similar to the threat they say they're facing in Eastern Europe. I think there are things they could do in Ukraine, for example, hitting the Azov battalion or some of the bases the Ukrainians have put on the Sea of Azov. They could deploy weapons to Kaliningrad Oblast. They could be announcing the targeting of European capitals. I think there are many things they could do to increase the pain level in Europe.
Russia has long warned against Ukraine's possible membership in NATO, describing it as its red line. Russia is raising the stakes by suggesting that it might deploy military hardware to Venezuela and Cuba if the escalation talks fail. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov, who led Russia's delegation in a meeting with the U.S. on Monday, says the move depends on the actions of the Americans. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan dismissed the warning as bluster, adding that the paths forward are either diplomacy or confrontation.
I think there's a chance of a compromise, but I think the chances are extremely small. I know some observers have taken some indications that maybe privately the Americans are willing to be more willing to make concessions to Moscow security demands, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think the Russians feel they were giving one last chance for the Western countries, particularly the United States, to see reason and give them security guarantees. I don't think that's going to happen.
Moscow and the West have had strained relations since the 2014 repatriation of Crimea from Ukraine to Russia, following a referendum in which more than 90% voted in favor of the move. The West, nonetheless, described it as illegal. The European Union and some other Western countries joined Washington in introducing several rounds of sanctions against Russia. The tense relations between the U.S. and Russia took a turn for the worse after Washington withdrew from Cold War-era IMF and Open Skies treaties. The recent tensions are definitely a cause for concern for people around the world, because if a second Cold War gets out of control, it could prove costlier than the first for all sides.
Arab intellectuals and ordinary people are still angry over UAE's normalization of ties with Israel. A number of intellectuals from Persian Gulf Arab states have announced that they will boycott a literature festival that is set to take place in Abu Dhabi in February. Omani writer Bushra Khalfan and Kuwaiti writers Mona Al-Shamri, Ahmed Al-Zamam and Ali Ashur decided to boycott the Emirates Airlines Festival of Literature.
Yeah, I guess this development indeed shows that there is a large number of people who disapprove. And that has been the case all along, because we need to keep in mind that these regimes are not elected by their population, and they don't necessarily make decisions on behalf of the population in these countries.
The intellectuals have cited UAE's normalization of ties with Israel for the decision to boycott the event. The list of invitees included writers, academics, and intellectuals from a number of Arab countries. Other writers from Persian Gulf countries have also been called to withdraw from the event. The festival will take place from February the 3rd to 13th at its new venue for 2022. UAE's image has been tarnished amongst Arab intellectuals and ordinary people for its decision to normalize ties. Palestinians have described the move as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
And of course, the public communication and freedom of speech is very strongly restricted in the UAE, which means that public dissent and in this case, and of course, public expressions against the normalization with the Israeli regime, of course, can lead to consequences for the populations.
The The United Arab Emirates is amongst a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States in 2020. The Emiratis opened their embassy in Israel in July 2021. Israel has also opened an embassy in the Emirates capital, Abu Dhabi, and the consulate in the UAE business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals ranging from financial services to tourism. And in December, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett visited the UAE to further deepen the ties between the two regimes. The UAE was not the only country to normalize its ties with Israel. Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco have also established diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already vowed to help Israel normalize relations with additional countries in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Blinken said the Biden administration would continue to build on the successful efforts of the last administration to keep normalization marching forward.
Well, the Israeli colony is in many ways a proxy and a military base for the United States, and it helps secure the U.S. role in Western Asia and beyond. So, of course, the Israeli regime is of essential importance for the United States, and expanding Israel's ties to the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and then potentially other governments and regimes in the region is, of course, of central interest because Israel is central for the military-industrial complex.
Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stance adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
Now, as a result, of course, the Palestinian struggle has not been of any importance, or has even rather become an obstacle for many of these regimes. But at the same time, of course, it does not reflect necessarily the popular mood in these places, where many people are, of course, pro-Palestinian and do support the liberation of Palestine.
Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel.
Earlier this month, in his New Year message, North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un pledged once again to boost Pyongyang's defenses. He said North Korea would continue to bolster its military capabilities because the peninsula still faces an increasingly unstable military environment. And now Kim seems determined to fulfill that pledge. This week he oversaw a hypersonic missile test. North Korean media said the projectile launched on Tuesday successfully made a turn before destroying its target 1,000 kilometers away. It was North Korea's third test of such a missile. South Korea's military acknowledged that the latest missile launch demonstrated quote-unquote improvement from previous tests. The North seems resolute on its path to master the new technology. Unlike ballistic missiles that fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory, hypersonic weapons fly at lower altitudes, making them less vulnerable to interception. The main feature of hypersonic weapons is their maneuverability, which makes them much harder to detect by radar. North Korea is now undoubtedly among a small number of countries, including the United States, racing to develop hypersonic weapons. The United States and some of its allies were quick to condemn the North's latest test. The U.S. did not stop there. It later announced sanctions against a number of individuals for their alleged roles in producing goods for Pyongyang's weapons program. The U.S. administration said the measures are aimed at preventing the advancement of North Korea's military programs and to block its attempts to develop weapons technologies. The sanctions imposed by the U.S. Treasury freeze all U.S. assets of those who are targeted and generally bans Americans from doing any business with them. Can such measures put obstacles in the way of North Korea's development of advanced weapons? Past experience shows that's highly unlikely because Pyongyang has been subjected to Western sanctions for many years. It has suffered under sanctions, but it has somehow managed to withstand the American pressure campaign.
Those sanctions continue to implement not just food, but also medicine, technology, equipment to make life impossible for the people of the DPRK, just as they're doing in Iran, just as they're doing in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua. But I think that these sanctions are not going to have much of an effect any longer, because we have to remember that the era of U.S. dominance, of the single dominance hegemony of the U.S. is over.
Despite its long list of economic problems, the North has managed to produce several nuclear warheads, describing them as a necessary insurance against an attack by the U.S. The North seems to deeply distrust America. Under former U.S. President Donald Trump, America and North Korea came close to a conflict before a series of meetings between the two adversaries. The high-profile summits broke down with no agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden insists that it is open to dialogue with North Korea. But Pyongyang seems to have learned a lesson from Trump's era and his futile attempts at detente.
I think the Biden administration, while in appearance it may seem that it's more progressive or more prone to dialogue, in reality it is very much achieving the same goals as Trump and the Republican strategy in general against the DPRK, which is regime change.
Pyongyang has described American diplomatic overtures as empty rhetoric without meaningful changes to hostile policies, including war games close to its borders and economic sanctions. The latest American sanctions are expected to further complicate the situation.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
Vafadar mondan be Islam va be inqilab. Ba hame wujood be Islam va inqilab vafadar mond. Be ahdi ke ba Khoda va ba Imam baste bood, be in ahd vafadar mond.
He was loyal to Islam and the revolution. He remained loyal to Islam and the revolution with all his heart and soul. He remained true to his covenant with God and Imam Khomeini. He remained loyal to his duty towards the Iranian nation and the Islamic nation with complete conscientiousness in his actions and all his being. He did his duty towards the Iranian nation and his duty towards the Islamic nation. Some people try to create a dichotomy between the Iranian nation and the Islamic nation. The root of this was started by the enemies, and it is they who are doing this. Some people negligently follow the same line. Inside the country too, we sometimes see the people who are working for the Islamic nation stop looking at and paying attention to the Iranian nation and vice versa. Inside the country too, we sometimes see the people who are working for the Islamic nation stop looking at and paying attention to the Iranian nation and vice versa. But our dear martyr, Marta Soleimani, proved that a person can be the one in the country who cares the most about his own nation and the most about the Islamic nation. He is the one who cared the most about his own nation and the most about the Islamic nation at the same time.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Militarin bud az koja ma'lum az tashir janazeh u.
He cared the most about his nation. How do we know this? We know this from his burial ceremony. Since the time of the revolution, which has been a time of great rallies and gatherings, what other example do we have of large gatherings of the people similar to the burial ceremony of Shahid Soleimani, in which tens of millions of people participated? Who were the people who participated in that ceremony? They were the whole nation. Well, a nation could not have been shown using delusions. The nation was an existing outside reality. Tens of millions of people came to that man's funeral ceremony after his martyrdom. So, he cared the most about his nation. He also cared the most about the Islamic nation. Over the past 2 years, his name and memory have been gathering more and more importance in the world of Islam. The name and memory of Marta Soleimani is repeatedly being mentioned in the world of Islam, and this is increasing. People can clearly see this. He was truly a manifestation of truthfulness, of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they have made with Allah.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been
Limelight. Disappointingly, U.S. actions are a key reason that the international community has been unable to enforce international law where the Zionist regime is concerned, says Ron Forthfor Ryder in an article titled "The U.S. Enables Criminal Israeli Regime Behavior." Stay tuned for more. Given all the attention focus on the COVID-19 pandemic, the Build Back Better bill, the January 6 attack on the capital, and the media-hyped crises over Ukraine and Taiwan this past year, many other important issues have not received much attention. One example is the Palestinian-Israeli regime situation. There have been some major breakthroughs in the perception of the Zionist regime in 2021, with two major human rights organizations, B'Tselem and Human Rights Watch, concluding that the Zionist regime is an apartheid regime. In addition, this past May, 93 U.S. rabbinical students wrote a letter challenging the Zionist perception of Israel. They wrote, "As American Jews, our institutions tell stories of Israel rooted in hope for what could be, but oblivious to what is. Our Tzedakah money funds a story we wish were true, but perpetuates a reality that is untenable and dangerous. Our political advocacy too often puts forth a narrative of victimization, but supports the violent suppression of human rights and enables apartheid in the Palestinian territories and the threat of annexation." The Zionist regime violates international law with impunity. There was also a particularly strong statement to the UN General Assembly this past October by Michael Link, the Special Rapporteur for the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territory occupied since 1967. Ian Williams wrote about Link's statement in the January to February 2022, the issue of the Washington Report on the West Asian Affairs. Williams quoted from Link's statement, "The international community has been perplexingly unwilling to meaningfully challenge, let alone act decisively to reverse, the momentous changes that Israel has been generating on the ground. This is a political failure of the first order. This very same international community, speaking through the principal political and legal organs of the United Nations, has established the widely accepted and detailed rights-based framework for the supervision and resolution of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Accordingly, the protracted Israeli occupation must fully end." Williams noted that Link also addressed the lack of action in following up on UN Security Council resolutions. Link said, "Regrettably, the international community's remarkable tolerance for Israeli exceptionalism in its conduct of the occupation has allowed real politics to trump rights, power to supplant justice, and impunity to undercut accountability. This has been conspicuous threat throughout the Madrid-Oslo peace process, which began in 1991. This past December 23rd, on the fifth anniversary of the UN Security Council's passing of Resolution 2334, Link said that Resolution 2334, adopted by the Security Council on December 23, 2016, stated that Israeli settlements constitute a flagrant violation under international law, and said that all settlement activities in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East al-Quds, must immediately and completely cease. If this resolution had been actually enforced by the international community and obeyed by Israel, we would most likely be on the verge of a just and lasting peace, the special rapporteur said, adding, "Instead, Israel is in defiance of the resolution, its occupation is more entrenched than ever, the violence it employs against the Palestinians to sustain the occupation is rising, and the international community has no strategy to end the world's longest military occupation." Link added, without decisive international intervention to impose accountability upon an unacceptable and unaccountable occupation, there is no hope that the Palestinian right to self-determination and an end to the conflict will be realized anytime in the foreseeable future. Disappointingly, U.S. actions are a key reason that the international community has been unable to enforce international law where the Zionist regime is concerned. For example, according to a May 19, 2021 Al Jazeera article, the U.S. has vetoed 53 U.N. Security Council resolutions critical of the Zionist regime's behavior since 1972. These shameful vetoes provide political cover for continuing the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians. In addition, the U.S. also gives $3.8 billion in aid each year to the Zionist regime, primarily for military assistance that, among other things, supports the Zionist regime's oppression of Palestinians and the occupation of Palestinian land. If peace and justice are to prevail, the U.S. must join with other nations to stop the Zionist regime's crimes instead of abetting the criminality.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place.
Now the Filimoya school has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This Iranian platform provides Afghan students with free educational courses.
Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses.
Hello everyone, how are you?
Now they are students of Filimoy School and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Filimo School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Filimo are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Filimo Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students.
I found the Filimo school extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by a political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Filimo school because they are in need of such opportunities.
Filimo school says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the ninth grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Nakab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
Well, there was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion, the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe cost in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached.
But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy.